Hello, and welcome to show number 2601 of Eyes on Success, a weekly program empowering the visually impaired with expert advice, personal stories, and the latest in technology and accessibility. I'm Nancy Goodman Torpy.
And I'm Pete Torpy. This week, we have a special guest to help us kick off our 16th year of hosting and producing Eyes on Success.
Although some of you may not know his name, Glenn Gordon was the driving force behind JAWS for Windows. In this two-part series, we'll talk with Glenn about his journey as a blind youth, his interest in radio, and what led him to become a leader in accessibility. Glenn will also share his struggles with overcoming years of tension and anxiety. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Glenn Gordon.
Don't be afraid to ask others for help. But this comes with a caveat. First, do as much research as you can. And when you're asking that other person for help, let them know all the things that you've experimented with on your own that you've not had a satisfactory answer from. In my experience, if you do that, those other people are going to become cheerleaders for you because they realize that you're invested in whatever the topic at hand is. Conversely, if you just ask them to solve the problem for you, you know, what's in it for them? You haven't tried to solve it. So that's something that I think has served me well. And it's served others well when they've come to ask me because my response is pretty similar. If they're in the business of trying to help themselves, but they need some help, I'm very eager to assist in any way I can.
And that has nothing to do with being blind. That applies equally to everybody. Try it yourself, and if you can't, be willing to accept help.
Yep, exactly.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
Let's start by meeting Glenn.
We are honored to have today's guest on the show. We've known him for about 30 years, and for people who don't know of him, he is the man who is very important in determining how I use my access technology. So, Glenn, can you tell people who you are and what you do or don't do these days?
Hi, I'm Glenn Gordon. What I do is different now than it was for the preceding 32 years, because starting back in 1994, I was one of the first two developers working on JAWS for Windows, and ultimately became the person who shepherded that forward and got the original JAWS 1.0 released. It ran for short periods of time. Fortunately, JAWS has improved over the years, and I've just loved working on that software for close to 32 years now. But I have left Freedom Scientific / Vispero and am now, quote, officially retired, but still planning to keep my hands involved in accessibility.
And we'll be talking to you as part of a two-part series. This week, we'll primarily discuss your personal life, and next week we'll be talking more about your professional life.
Sounds good.
Well, Glenn, people probably know that you have been visually impaired for a long time, right?
A very long time, 67 plus years.
Was that retinopathy of prematurity or something else?
It was definitely something else. They're never really quite sure. My optic nerve atrophied, apparently, during pregnancy and did not fully develop.
So where did you grow up? And tell us a little bit about your childhood.
I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles, North Hollywood, to be specific. And at the time, all blind kids in the Los Angeles area got bused to Francis Blend School for the Blind. That's where I spent my first 7 years, if you count kindergarten, of education. Generally, from an education standpoint, it was great because I learned Braille. I learned how to compute basic math. I learned how to type. Essentially, all things that would serve me well when I moved on to junior high school and ultimately higher education. From a social standpoint, it was odd. My parents, from a very early age, made it extremely clear to me that they were not going to take care of me much past the age of my majority, and that I would be expected to make a living and take care of myself. They also made it pretty clear that the best path for someone who was blind, in their minds, was to get a good education. Because without the education, I would have had far fewer paths open to me. So that's the attitude that I had from early on. So to me, it was never an option to fail.
You mentioned that the social experience at the School for the Blind was less positive. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Not all of my colleagues in elementary school had been given those same incentives by their families. They were not ambitious. And even back then, I had this feeling that if I hung out with them too much, that some of that lack of ambition could perhaps wear off on me. But it also meant that I didn't search outside my world for other blind people, people that I could really use as role models. That would have been really useful as I moved through life. And it was only shortly before I started working in the accessibility field that I began to meet blind people who were far more accomplished than I and realized that I had been missing out for many years. But that missing out, I think, was spurred, in fact, by interacting with people who didn't have the same ambitions that I did.
What were your interactions with sighted youth like when you were young?
My family did have the insight to get me involved in Gray Y and Cub Scouts, Junior High Y, things that were in the neighborhood. So I did meet people who were sighted, who didn't go to the School for the Blind, obviously, but many of whom became friends of mine. And when I transitioned to the local junior high school, I had a cadre of people I could hang out with. So that worked out really well.
So it sounded like after leaving the School for the Blind and attending public school and college, you were sort of geared for success already. How did school go for you?
Amazingly well.
And then, as you mentioned, you eventually got your MBA. What did you major in college as an undergraduate?
I majored in business, and then I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I got my MBA.
So we've known you primarily through your work developing JAWS and being a really top-notch computer programmer, but that was not your first job. What else did you do before getting into that?
My first job actually was in computing, but before that, I loved broadcasting. I was one of those blind people who loved radio. Wanted to be a disc jockey, which freaked my father out. He was a business negotiator for various television networks. He had his law degree, and he knew that radio was an unstable business. But he was smart enough not to tell my 12-year-old self, you can't be in radio. He sort of said it a little bit more lightly, but he was always willing to take me around to radio stations to meet disc jockeys. So I would call them up and say, can I come visit you with my father? And most of the time they would say yes, which meant that I met a whole bunch of them. And in the course of visiting with them periodically, I would hear about their careers and I would trace their careers just by listening to them on the radio and finding out that one day someone was working, one day they weren't working, they were at another station. And I came to realize that radio indeed was an unstable profession back then. Comparatively, it's like 100 times less stable now than it was then. And unless you were one of a very small number back then, you didn't really make a particularly good living. So I'm glad my dad's approach worked and that I decided I probably needed to do something else.
Did your work in radio start as you were going through school or after you completed your MBA?
It started in high school.
Wow.
I had a friend who took a Heathkit shortwave transmitter, converted it to work on AM radio, and we broadcasted 100 watts every Saturday, playing records and talking. We had two turntables. We had a mixing console that he built. It was more fun than I've ever had in broadcasting since, even though nobody was listening. It was fun until the FCC came and knocked on the door one evening.
Oops.
That was the end of that.
In fact, your career in radio led to you meeting your current wife.
It did, in fact. At the time, I was doing two radio shows. I was doing a 50s and 60s rock and roll program on the college radio station at Cal State Northridge. I also was hosting an hour-long weekly program talking about disabilities, interviewing people with different disabilities, people working in that field, understanding their lives, you know, not unlike FSCast. It was just a little broader in terms of subject matter. So when I heard another radio station where they were basically doing a dating game on the air, where one person would call in, typically a woman, she would then talk a bit about herself, then the host would interview three different bachelors. The woman was able to ask each of the bachelors questions, and then she would pick someone to go on a date with, which, by the way, the station did not pay for. It was me, it was a plastic extrusions inspector, and somebody who wanted to take her to bluegrass festivals. I was very careful when I was making my cameo appearance to not mention that I was a computer nerd, nor did I mention that I loved bluegrass. But I was able to sort of sway things in a manner that maybe would make her interested in me.
And apparently that worked out.
Yes, apparently it did. We were married within 6 months, and it's been nearly 40 years. It'll be 40 years this coming July.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
So I know you're a big collector of records and recordings and really into music these days. And it makes me kind of curious, with your MBA and your background, how did you learn about computers? Because that was eventually your long-term job at Vispero and Freedom Scientific and Hector Joyce.
Remember when I said it would have been really useful to have blind people in my sphere of influence in those early years before I started my MBA program? There were a couple, but there weren't a lot. Back in those days, if you didn't hear about something word of mouth, you likely wouldn't hear it. There was no such thing as the internet, which meant that I completely missed out on the Apple IIe and other early computers that had some level of accessibility, which meant that I was relatively late to the party. Turns out that when I was in my MBA program, they had an HP 3000 mini computer, and I had a VersaBraille. A VersaBraille was this device that had a 20-cell Braille display, a Braille keyboard, and a cassette recorder all together. The cassette recorder was used as a disk drive would be used today to store data off, but the VersaBrailler also worked as a terminal. And so I was able to log into the HP 3000 using my modem, connect, and even though it was not full screen applications, I was able to do quite a bit. HP also had much of their documentation online, which meant that I became sort of a voracious reader of technical knowledge and ultimately gained knowledge of the HP 3000. If you're in business school and you have any aptitude for computing, it is rewarded because there are things to do. There are tasks that need accomplishing, and most people who are in business school have no interest in coding.
And the rest of your students and faculty think that anybody who can do any coding at all must be brilliant. So that works pretty well for your reputation.
Absolutely. Had I been in a computer science program, who knows where I would have fallen. But there, I began volunteering and then became a student TA in the computer center. So by the time I graduated, I decided, against the suggestions of all of my MBA colleagues, to stay at the business school and help computerize the administrative side of it. People were telling me, your career is going to be ruined, you'll never be able to get another job, you'll be locked in the academic prison forever. It was a choice of staying at UCLA or working at Hughes Aircraft. Hughes Aircraft was the only company that offered me a job. But I would have really needed to completely uproot myself. And I wasn't delighted about the idea of working in the military-industrial complex. So those two things together caused me to stay at UCLA.
Well, that explains your background in computing. I was always curious about that transition from loving radio and music to getting into developing screen readers.
I just liked computing. I started in the HP 3000, which was a proprietary operating system, but very quickly thereafter, the business school got an HP 9000, which was Unix. And for those who know Linux, Unix was a precursor to it. Linux had a graphical UI, but it was completely inaccessible. So I was doing everything at the command line. And come 1993, 1994, Windows was taking off. I was deathly afraid that my career would be lost because Windows was going graphical, Unix was going graphical. And it just so happened that I met Ted Henter because the HP 150 computer that I got to work with the HP 3000, so I finally had some full screen access. The HP 150 was modified by Blazy Computing. Ted worked for Dean at the time. We became friendly because Ted did tech support and I had tons of questions. One thing led to the next, and several years later, I started working under his tutelage on JAWS.
Well, Glenn, you've been very successful in your career and very key to many of the accessibility tools much of us have these days. And people tend to look at people like that and say, wow, things went so well and so easy for them. They were so successful. It must be great. But you've gone through your hard times also, unbeknownst to many people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I wouldn't have said so at the time, but it really was 20 years. The short version is that I didn't know how to use my body and how to relax. It all began right around the time I started working for Henter Joyce, actually. I was still working part-time for UCLA. A friend of mine there had moved on to a different department, and she asked me if I would do voiceover for some films that they were creating. So she sent me the scripts. I had just set up my equipment in Ithaca. I was particularly anxious. And throughout the course of recording this hour of narration, I was not using my voice properly and did something or other that caused my vocal cords to rub together in just the wrong way. And so it was this burning pain in the back of my throat, which for the first couple of days didn't faze me very much. But over time, I began to compensate in a way that I thought would be protecting my vocal cords, which in reality was just tightening up my body in every way possible. And that problem, although the symptoms faded away, I started sleeping again where previously I had not been sleeping well. I took clonazepam to help sleep, but of course that doesn't really work very well long term. So I worked through this by simply ignoring it. And over time, I calmed down and things got better for a couple of years, but I went through it again in 98, again in 2005, and again in 2011. All variants of the same thing, because I never worked at the underlying problems.
So these instances would sort of come and go.
They would come and go, but coming, it really was like a switch flipped. I would feel fine one day, then I would have a sleepless night or two, and then it would start coming back. I didn't see there was any purpose in going on. It was complete panic, and it was also believing that because I could solve things in the technical world, I could solve things for myself, which meant that my physical tension, which I didn't translate as such at the time, but my problems of not sleeping and not breathing freely and all these other things got translated by me into a problem that I could solve by thinking my way out of the box. Then when I couldn't think my way out of the box, it got even worse because I said, I can't solve this.
I can relate to that. You know, analytical people tend to think if they can solve a problem on paper or on a computer, they can solve a problem for their own body and for themselves.
It turns out that the time was right. I was so desperate in 2012 because this problem, in addition to everything else, translated into my hands hurting more, my arms hurting more, which meant that I couldn't really work efficiently or effectively. It was suggested that I go to a Feldenkrais practitioner, which is Feldenkrais for anyone wanting to play at home.
And what does it mean?
Feldenkrais was Moshe Feldenkrais, someone in Israel who came up with this method of re-educating one's body on how to do things with less effort. It turns out that by seeing and working with a Feldenkrais teacher for many years, I was able, through her doing gentle manipulations of my body, things like trying to push my arm out to the side, but stopping whenever she picked up the smallest amount of resistance, and then going back into the easy area and gradually moving the arm and other limbs and other parts of my body, trying to get some of that resistance to break down. The result was that at the end of a Feldenkrais lesson, I felt more relaxed than I have ever felt before. Now, it didn't last initially, right? Within 5 or 10 minutes, it was gone, and I was back to my tension. But I was given a new target to aim for, because prior to that, I was always in a state of tension. I had a friend who was a massage therapist, and she said, I've never met anyone who is as tight as you are. Feldenkrais, for me, was the most transformative experience of my life because I was able to learn to use my body more effectively and in a more relaxed state. Now, there are some guided lessons. You can go to feldenkrais.com and you can download a bunch of them. I worked with her from 2013 through the early part of 2020 up until the pandemic. And it was the best thing that I ever did because for the first time, I actually got at the root of the problems that started in 94.
How did you come to find out about the Feldenkrais method?
Through a psychiatrist, of all people. I was seeing a psychiatrist because a well-meaning GP put me on to high doses of clonazepam. By the way, if someone offers you clonazepam, do your best not to take it. It is very hard to get off of. That was also one of the hardest things that I ever did.
What is it?
It's a cousin of Valium. It's something to help you relax. But once it gets into your system, it has a very long half-life, and it's very hard to clear your system of it without getting back the symptoms that you originally went onto it for, except when the symptoms come back, they come back like magnified 10 times.
So this apparently took many years working with a professional, but you haven't done that since 2020. Is this now something you can do yourself that you've been trained well enough in and it relieves all the symptoms?
I'm sure if I were to see her again, she would find all sorts of places where I'm tense. But if I was 100% tense for most of my life, you know, maybe I'm 10% tense now. It was that profound a difference.
And can you repeat the website for Feldenkrais?
You can go to feldenkrais.com.
And in the show notes for this episode, which is episode 2601, we'll have links to a number of previous episodes in which Glenn appeared, and also several episodes in which he interviewed us. The other thing we'll have, we talked about Glenn meeting his wife Jan in a radio meetup program, and we'll have a link to an episode in which that appeared. And if you look in that episode, that clip starts at about 10 minutes into the audio. And one other announcement for this week. This is the first episode for which we'll start adding transcripts to the shows. So if you're looking for a text transcript, click on the transcript button and download the transcript for that episode. I hope you enjoy that. Let us know what you think.
That's it for today's show. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be continuing the conversation with part two of this two-part series. And next week, we'll be talking with Glenn Gordon about his early work developing JAWS, major changes in screen reader technology over the years, balancing AI with traditional methods, and Glenn's retirement plans to improve accessibility in some open source projects.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, available wherever you get your podcasts.
For show notes, resources, and more information, visit our website at eyesonsuccess.net.
Thank you for being part of our community. Until next time, I'm Peter Torpy.
And I'm Nancy Goodman Torpy. Thank you for listening.